We would love it if you would go to donate.npr.org/happy and support your local station and also support our show. We'll tell you more later. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. As we close out the year, there's nothing we love more than to take a moment to share some fresh thoughts about some of the very best things we saw and heard and read in 2017, from the funniest performances to the most encouraging trends. It's just the three of us this week. I'm here with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
And, of course, Glenn Weldon is here from the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
This is a day that is all about favorites, and we want to get going right away. Glenn, you are up first. Favorite from 2017.
You know who's had a year? Laura Dern has a year. The Dernissance. It's a F5 Dernado. Call it what you will. She's derned every penny. She started out with a couple small parts, like on really good shows. Last Man on Earth, she had a part. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, she had like a little cameo thing. She was a small part in Wilson, the Daniel Clowes film, but it's really about the big three. She was on Big Little Lies on HBO
as the
extremely memeable Renata in many different ways. She was fantastic in that. She played Diane on Twin Peaks. The best thing about Twin Peaks, The Return, she co-starred with a wig, with a icy white blonde bob, which was just fantastic. She was great. And we haven't seen it yet because we're taping it early, but she is also in The Last Jedi, playing Vice Admiral Amelin Holdo. She gets a dumb name. You've arrived in the Star Wars universe when you get one of their dumb names. Not much is known about the character, except she's described as eccentric and quirky, which, yep and yep. That is good casting, and she also co-stars with a purple wig this time.
Oh, so, wow.
Nice.
Go Laura Dern.
All right, Glenn Weldon says the Dernissance. What's up with you, Stephen Thompson? Give me a favorite.
One of my favorite, I guess, trends of 2017 was stories of secular Muslim assimilation in America, which seems like that would be, like there
hot,
wouldn't be.
A hot trend? Muslims.
I know, but there were three incredibly funny and warm and charming and beautiful stories, all of which kind of popped up in 2017. The second season of Master of None with Aziz Ansari focuses specifically on his relationship to religion, particularly in the episode Religion. Hasan Minhaj, the wonderful comedian, put out a great Netflix special called Hasan Minhaj, Homecoming King, in which he tells his story of his upbringing and his relationship to that upbringing and to his parents. And finally, of course, The Big Sick.
Heard of it.
We have shied away from talking about that film in detail because Kumail Nanjiani is our pal. But that is a wonderful movie, and it had an incredible moment, in kind of a moment that lasted throughout the whole back half of 2017, where the story of him falling in love and obviously overcoming his now wife's illness, but also his relationship to his family, which that movie goes into great and warm and loving detail. The fact that all three of those stories existed in 2017, I think, speaks to a larger shift in the culture toward telling stories we haven't already heard a thousand times, and I think that's a theme we will come back to again on this episode. That has been such a joy-inducing development in the culture this year.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I would agree with all of those things. I endorse all of those cultural products. So the first thing that I want to talk about as a favorite is the reboot of One Day at a Time that came up on Netflix. And as we spoke about when it first came out, it takes a little while to get situated in this show, which stars Justina Machado and the great Rita Moreno and a Latino cast. And the family is Cuban-American. It's a reboot of the 1970s Norman Lear show. And he participated in this as well. It takes some time to get situated because it has those old sitcom roots and you hear audience laughter and things like that, which people are beginning to not be used to on sort of Netflix or more prestige-y comedies, if I can say that. But it really turned out to be a show that had so much to say about families and so much to say about a wide variety of topics, stories involving, you know, sexual identity and race and things that you really don't hear about very much, including religion and service in the armed forces, neither of which are great topics where television has tended to lead, I would say. And of course, it was part of a year in which hopefully people continued to learn the importance of representation. And it strikes a blow for that. But at the same time, it's also just a really funny comedy. And I think they thread the needle very well between the show is not about the fact that it's a Cuban-American family solely, but the show embraces the fact that it's a Cuban-American family. So I really liked the way that that show looked at representation. So One Day at a Time.
It's coming back.
Yep, it absolutely is.
And Justina Machado is such a star. I love her.
She really is. I want to watch her in absolutely everything. Yep. Glenn, give me another one.
The Year in Queer. Movies, that is. You know, it's been a great year for queer movies, movies that deal with queer sexuality and, but not necessarily, follows queer identity. So I am, by any reasonable measure, a cynical jerk, and my taste in pop culture tends to follow that. But this year, something has changed within me. Something is not the same. And I have been seeking out movies that treat their characters with kindness, even-handedness, where they're not mocked. I still have a taste for satire. Any film that tries to go after, like, a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot, I am there. But I just saw this film called Princess Cid. Princess Cid is a very small film about a blunt, headstrong young woman, a teenager who goes to visit her aunt in Chicago. The aunt is a writer. Cid doesn't read. So the conflict you think is going to happen, and Stephen, we talked about this when we talked about Call Me By Your Name, how the conflict isn't necessarily between the characters. It's coming from someplace else.
Right.
The conflict here is really them struggling to connect. You could push on this film a little bit. If the director pushed on the performances even a little bit, you know, Cid, the girl, would be a vapid, sullen teenager, and the aunt would be a pretentious writer, and that film is there under the surface, but that's not the film here. This film is about people struggling to connect and finding things along the way. It's small, and it's gentle, and it's not conventionally cinematic, and that's, I think, what's happening. Queer folk, when we're telling stories now, we have all these topics we have been telling stories about, which are naturally cinematic, naturally dramatic, coming out, homophobia, dealing with violence, dealing with AIDS, suicide, which, you know, it's a cliche, terrible ending of gay stories, but it is dramatic. You can't deny that it is. But that we're now telling stories in which queer sexuality is a big part of the story, but queer identity may or may not be. Case in point, Call Me By Your Name. Queer sexuality, but do those guys identify as gay? Maybe, maybe not. That's not the issue. That's not what that's about. God's Own Country, a fantastic film about, follow me here, a tortured Yorkshire farmhand on a sheep farm who finds a beardy, soulful Georgian farmhand in a great sweater who they come together in this very unforgiving, natural, harsh environment. So if you're a cynical jerk, you would refer to it as Brokeback Mountain, but... But let's not. Let's not. 4 Days in France, about a guy who leaves his partner just to go cruising on Grindr all across France. There's also BPM, which, of course, is about the Paris ACT UP chapter. That's AIDS. I Am Michael, the James Franco film about the guy who claims to be an ex-gay. A Fantastic Woman, a fantastic film from Chile about transphobia in a real way. And Thelma, which is kind of a very strange Norwegian film about kind of combines coming out and Carrie. So it's kind of a queer Carrie. And, of course, Beach Rats. Now, of all these films, Beach Rats is the only one that I feel like could have been made 20 years ago, right? Because it's telling the same story of a kid struggling with his identity and lashing out. But these other films are expressing sexuality without worrying about it, without policing it, without saying what it is. And I think that's reflecting of kind of the new generation coming up, and I am here for it.
Absolutely. And to mention a couple others that involve women.
Yeah.
At Toronto, I saw on the same day Battle of the Sexes.
Sure. Yep.
And I also saw a couple of films that aren't out yet that involve queer relationships among women. Mm-hmm. So good catch there, buddy. All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, what have you got for us?
Well, I wanted to talk about Wonder Woman. We like Wonder Woman.
Yep.
Wonder Woman had a big, big, big year. I wanted to highlight a moment in the movie Justice League that made my appreciation for Wonder Woman that much truer. Linda, you haven't seen Justice League, right?
That's correct.
Okay, there is a scene in Justice League where Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman is walking upstairs and the camera pans in tight on her butt.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is off-putting, and it is a reminder of one of the reasons that people like Wonder Woman so much more than they like Justice League. And it speaks to why Wonder Woman was a special movie in 2017. Linda, you and I think Petra Mayer were talking about how much you like teared up during the fight scenes mm-hmm. in Wonder Woman. The fact that Wonder Woman was directed by Patty Jenkins, who shot that movie with love and deference for that character that never bothered to leer at her, is part of what made that movie so refreshing and what had so many people excited about that film. There were a couple of my favorite movies of 2017 that were directed by women and benefited so greatly from coming from that perspective. My favorite film of 2017 so far, and I have not seen all the major awardsy movies, is Lady Bird, directed by Greta Gerwig. And just kind of the rise of women directors, which you're going to see a whole lot more of in the coming years, just produced some of my favorite movie-going experiences.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. The next thing that I want to talk about is not a surprise to anyone who's been following cultural criticism this year. That is Get Out, written and directed by Jordan Peele. Uh-huh. Get Out, you know, there's been a lot of talk about its very intelligent commentary kind of buried under semi-comedy. There's the Golden Globes are taking Get Out as a comedy, which right. has riled a lot of people up. But to me, its strength, one of its strengths, is that it does take these important points that it wants to make. And they do live within moments that are sometimes comedic, either very, very darkly comedic, or in some cases, regular comedic. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Jordan Peele, coming out of sketch comedy and people knowing him from Key and Peele, things like that, has an eye for that. One of the things I love about Get Out is that the horror genre is so big. Mm-hmm. And it's great to me to see people innovate inside a very popular genre.
Right, yeah.
And what Jordan Peele really does here is he takes a lot of tropes of horror and turns them around in an interesting way. So I think Get Out, in addition to just being a good, scary, funny, really thought-provoking film, is just a great engine for kind of culture going forward to create a lot of good conversations. It's also, like a couple of other movies this year, I, Tonya being one of them, it's a film where I love reading the writing about it, mm-hmm. In addition to mm-hmm. it being good and interesting film. It's generated a lot of good writing.
It's yeah. a great movie.
So Get Out, a non-controversial pick for a great thing from 2017. I have one that I am extremely excited to talk about again, and that is Girls Trip.
Sure.
If you are not familiar with Girls Trip, first of all, get your life. Second of all, Girls Trip is about four women friends going to the Essence Festival. I think it is best known, perhaps, at this point for the emergence of Tiffany Haddish, who plays one of the women. But I think in general, it was so refreshing right in the middle of such a punishing year for a lot of people in watching the news and all of that. I think it was really good to have a very silly mm-hmm. and yet in its own way very thoughtful film that really was about friendship and features a great fight, which every film about friends needs. It was very much a cultural turnabout in that the men in it are uniformly just shot so loving uh-huh. from an aesthetic
nice way to put it.
Perspective. I think it really allowed the women in it to have a moment of pure comedy together that unfortunately doesn't happen all that often. Again, I think that the fact that it will bring more opportunities for Tracy Oliver, who's one of the mm-hmm. screenwriters, she, like Jordan Peele, is signed on to future projects, including a television remake of The First Wives Club that she's working on that I'm very excited about. And of course, yes, Tiffany Haddish, the more I see of her in funny things, the happier I am
yep.
at this point. She is one of those people where she's worked for a long, long, long time. She did not come out of nowhere. But, you know, it's always nice to see somebody have their moment. I think it's richly deserved. And that's, you know, so that makes me very happy. More opportunities for Tracy Oliver, more opportunities for Tiffany Haddish, and more opportunities for me to laugh at very, 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 very silly jokes.
There you go.
I like it. Girls Trip. All right. Glenn, you're up next.
Yeah, we've already had an entire episode about American Vandal, but I do want to call it out here again because it is just so good. I had occasion to see it again with my family over Thanksgiving, and this thing knows what it wants to do from the jump, and it proceeds to do it. It becomes, on its second viewing, funnier. and more devastating at the same time. So American Vandal, it's great.
Yeah, I had occasion recently to be live texted while one of my friends was watching it for the first time. So I was getting all the little texts. This is so good. Have you seen this?
Oh, I realized how well suited that is to be shared with teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm planning a viewing with my kids.
Yeah, American Vandal, a mock documentary on Netflix based on sort of your serial and making a murderer type of shows, but it's about a high school vandalism case. Very good, very funny. And also, as Glenn said, quite devastating. Stephen Thompson, speaking of quite devastating.
Well, I'm talk about your big meatball pitches up the middle. The album of the year across basically every critical quadrant is Damn by Kendrick Lamar. And I talked a lot about To Pimp a Butterfly, his previous record, which was this sprawling, incredibly thematically ambitious masterpiece. This record at first kind of came out and everybody sort of felt like, well, this is more contained. This is more singles. This is less ambitious. And then the more we spent time with it and the more we unpacked it, it is no less ambitious. And it's got your hits. Like, he had a chart-topping hit kind of for the first time, like as a single with Humble. He also had one of my very, very, very favorite songs of the year, which I kept waiting for it to come out as a single, and it finally did. Jessica, hit me a little bit with Love.
I'm on the way. We ain't got no time to waste. Popping your gum on the way. And mine away. I don't want pressure you none. I want your blessing today. Oh, by the way. Open the door, by the way. Tell you that I'm on the way. I'm on the way. I know connection is vague. Pick up the phone for me, babe. Damn it, we jamming. That had a two for your nanny. Curving your hip from your mammy. Remember Gardena. I took the studio camera. I know Top will be mad at me. I had to do it. I want your body.
The song manages to be loving and longing and sexy and still packed with ideas at the same time. I love this record so much. That is not a controversial statement, but I mean, I certainly hope it is the album of the year at the Grammys. It had a moment that lasted the entire year. Damn by Kendrick Lamar.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. The next thing on my list is a book by Johnny Sun called Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien Too. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with him, a lot of people know him from Twitter. You know, he started off as kind of an absurdist who I think a lot of people associated with just kind of weird Twitter and all that stuff. I feel like he's gotten to be better known as kind of a public empath. And I think his evolution into that has been really beautiful to watch. And this book is, he does illustrations, he does drawings with, you know, a little bit of dialogue. And the book is a story. The book is a story about an alien and his explorations of Earth and talking to animals and things like that. It's very, very hard to explain if you haven't read it. Again, it's called Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien Too. And it touches on several things that I think are important that are going on right now. One is that it's a bit of a format breaker, just a very unconventional kind of book, and that it's somewhat interactive. A lot of people color this book in because of the nature of the illustrations. It makes a very good coloring project, if that's your kind of thing. I think the kindness, you know, it's not a way of looking at the world that says everything is fine and everybody is okay. It's just very generous toward the alien and the, it's as I said, it's hard to explain, but if you seek it out, he's listed in some places and not other places as Jomny, J-O-M-N-Y, Son, but, or Johnny Son. You can also find some wonderful writing about him that happened this year. So Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien Too.
Nice.
By Johnny Son. All right, Glenn Weldon.
I talked about George Saunders' audiobook, Lincoln in the Bardo, his first novel. But I want to talk about that book as a piece of writing, because it's about the death of Abraham Lincoln's 11-year-old son, Willie. Abraham Lincoln goes to visit his grave right here in Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown. And we hear over the course of this novel from various ghosts. So it's kind of like the last act of Our Town or Spoon River Anthology. The Bardo is a Tibetan Buddhist term for the kind of transition space between life and death. And we get all these intersecting voices that are sad and lonely and very funny, and it just builds and builds. And that's what's fantastic about it, the way it builds to become this marvelous achievement, because there is no guarantee that a master of the short story form like George Saunders could do a novel. Mm-hmm. They are fundamentally different forms. They have different demands, different expectations, and I had no reason to think, really, that he could pull this thing off. But he does in such a hugely satisfying way. And it made me look forward to what's coming next from him, whether it's short stories or another big project like this. But it's just masterful. And it's Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, I do not think that your next pick is going to be a book, even though I don't know what your next pick is. Tell me what your next pick
is. Well, I mean, it's really just, it's so close to a book. It is Super Mario Odyssey.
There you go.
Sure. For the most literary of the Mario games.
It is. Specifically for the Nintendo Switch. I have played a number of Mario games over the years. I have in my house the original Mario Brothers in the sewers fighting turtles and crabs.
Sure.
Arcade machine. So I've been there with Mario.
You're OG.
I'm OG Mario. Mm-hmm. This game, which my son has played for approximately 600 hours, it's a 3D platform game. So Mario is generally running kind of left to right, occasionally up and down, as he ventures through to try to rescue Peach from Bowser or whatever his objective is. It's usually to save Peach. In Super Mario Odyssey, I'm still learning how to play it. Just the mechanics of it are so odd to me as somebody who is used to kind of a two-dimensional video game world. Mm-hmm. But the visual invention in this game, just the simple idea that Mario is going through this world with Cappy, his sort of anthropomorphized hat, which he can throw sometimes just as a weapon, but sometimes to assume the form of something else in the game. So he will suddenly turn into a different character or turn into an object or turn into the bullet bill or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, whatever he needs to kind of eventually get through this level. It is such an interesting take on a character that has been run through so many iterations of video games dating back 35 years to have a game which has done extraordinarily well and which is massively acclaimed. It and Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild are two of the big video game hits of the year, also for the Switch. And both of them are just these kind of endlessly imaginative worlds that you are traveling through. It's just, video games are in a very interesting place right now, and I wanted to call attention specifically to Super Mario Odyssey.
There you go.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I don't feel like it would be a 2017 list of favorites without some YouTube videos, without some of the videos that live in the space of when I'm sitting at my desk and I need a pick-me-up, this is the kind of stuff that I love to watch. And my favorite YouTube channel is Ladylike from BuzzFeed. They basically do experiments in fashion and beauty. It's a team of women who try different things and document the results. You know, some of them are fairly whimsical and short term, like we tried a particular kind of beauty mask or something like that. They try out a lot of trends. They try out a certain number of infomercial type mm-hmm. products, like we tried this thing that's supposed to curl your hair overnight. But they do these really, they're very funny, but they're also, the women have a real camaraderie to them. And there's a lot of interesting gender commentary always inside of these videos, because what I really like about them, beauty videos are a really common and big part of YouTube, if you're talking about tutorials and things like that. These are, you know, it is seeing trends and things to try on real people who talk about the experience. And what I love about it is they're not always skeptical. I mean, they're always unsure. And sometimes they come out of it saying, this is really stupid and I don't think it's worth the money. But sometimes, you know, a very common result is that one of them will find, this kind of lipstick looks really good on me and works for me. And, you know, others will find, this is crazy and I didn't like it. But I really like some of the stuff that they do that's about challenging their own expectations of how a beauty regimen should work. They'll do, we didn't shave our legs for X period of time. They'll do, we didn't wear underwear for X period of time. We wore the same clothes over and over again. Those are to challenge their own ideas about how they relate to fashion and beauty. And I think they're fascinating. My personal hero is Kristen Cherico, who does a lot of stuff for them about like plus size fashion and things like that. So when they try out, for example, historical bras, which was one they did recently, the bullet bra and a kind of a wrap situation, W-R-A-P. You have women of different sizes who have different kinds of bodies who try all that stuff out. I love Kristen. She's so funny and such a joy. BuzzFeed's Ladylike video series. I love them. Check them out. Glenn Weldon, hit me.
My last one is a comic book. It's called Mr. Miracle. And, I was going to call it out for the book concierge this year, but we're only 4 issues in at this taping, so it's not been collected anywhere, so it doesn't qualify. But, man, I love this comic. Mr. Miracle is a minor character in the DC pantheon. He is one of what's called the Fourth World, the New Gods, which is this whole world created by Jack Kirby, which is just filled with just cosmic battles and stentorian declarations and incredibly, over-elaborate, over-designed costumes with bright primary colors and incredible technology. It's everything about it is big. It is old school comic booking in its finest form. This book, Mr. Miracle, is the opposite of that, intentionally so. It is very quiet and inward and intimate. So Mr. Miracle, same guy from that big bombastic world, but here he's depressed. He's suicidal. He may or may not be a pawn in some kind of ongoing cosmic struggle. He probably is, but the struggle of the book is him trying to get through the day. And the art is just exceptional because it's this rigid 9-panel grid, which is very sort of comforting and familiar, but it also is a little oppressive. This book is written by Tom King with art by Mitch Gerads, and every so often Gerads futzes with the 9-panel grid so that we know something is up. We don't know what yet, but something is not what it seems. They're playing with time as well. There's an entire page sometimes taken up by somebody processing information. So an entire page of their expression changing as they figure out what's going on. Issue 4, which just came out, is a mock trial that takes place in Mr. Miracle's living room. So you've got all these characters in these giant costumes with all these antennas coming off their heads, and they're sitting in this shabby living room on a crappy couch, and they're going back and forth about, the ultimate fate of the universe. And every so often they take a break to reach over to a supermarket-bought plastic veggie tray and dip a baby carrot into the ranch dip.
Nice.
And then they go back to that. It's just so good. It's so smart. Taking these larger-than-life figures and kind of trying to find them. If you liked Hawkeye, that comic from a few years back, this is kind of in that same mode. So that is Mr. Miracle. I love it.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, bring us home.
I did not have a hard time coming up with what I would choose as 2017's Song of the Year. I would say that the Song of the Year was emblematic of 2017 in many, many ways. That song is Praying by Kesha. Jessica, hit me. In the 5-year buildup to Kesha's album Rainbow, which finally came out this year, so much had been written about this very heavily publicized scandal in which she had charged her former producer, Dr. Luke, of physical and sexual abuse. And she was involved in a lot of legal disputes that in part kept her from releasing new music. And to have this album come out in a year in which so many people were grappling with the aftermath of terrible allegations and discoveries, to have a song come out of that, to have her return come with this song, which is this, it's a statement of self-control and a statement of power. It's also a statement of grace and kind of finding a new place in the world in the aftermath of all these problems. And I think that having this one song, this very intense, very emotive song, to me really spoke to this moment in time. That song fits within this album called Rainbow, which in many ways is very silly and very fun and very celebratory. She does not come out on the side of haters on this album at all. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's like it's my pop album of the year. But it comes with this song that every time it came on the radio, just really knocked me over with not only its intensity, but with what I think is real power.
Kesha.
The year of Kesha.
You know, it's interesting to me that for all of us, some of the things that moved us most this year have, as we've been talking about, a grace to them, mm-hmm. a kindness to them, uh-huh. as opposed to the sort of super pointy, cynical direction that a lot of things went, I think, for a number of years. It wasn't just the things I picked, but basically everything I considered picking.
Yeah, maybe when the world catches up to your cynicism, you start looking for other things besides that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to hear from as many of you as want to tell us about all the things that moved you in 2017. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. Before we go, thanks to all of you who have been to donate.npr.org/happy and have supported our show by supporting your local public radio station. If you have not yet done that, please go and do that and tell us why public radio is a big part of your life. And you know what the hashtag is for that? It's hashtag why public radio, logically enough. It means so much to us, and we really, really appreciate it. That brings us to the end of our show. Thanks for being here, as always, you guys.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We're so, so grateful that you spent the year with us. We look forward to seeing you in 2018. In the meantime, if you have a second and you're so inclined, close out your year by giving us an affectionate review on Apple Podcasts. It does help other people to find the show. And happy holidays if you're celebrating, and we will see you right back here next week.